From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The World Economic Forum has begun in Davos, Switzerland, bringing together business and state representatives in what AFP calls the world's most exclusive business bash. This year, the U.S. will not be represented at Davos as President Donald Trump canceled travel plans for his cabinet representatives, citing the ongoing federal government shutdown. Meanwhile, Oxfam has released its annual report on global inequality to coincide with the start of the World Economic Forum, as it does every year. This year's report is entitled Public Good or Private Wealth, and addresses the deep impact that low tax rates for the fabulously wealthy have on the public services that ordinary people rely on. My guest is Paul O'Brien, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America. Welcome, Paul.
Nice to be here, Sonali.
I want to talk a little bit about what's happening in Davos, but let's discuss the report first. So as I said, Oxfam does this every year. And this year, public services is a major focus. And of course, public services are funded by taxes. And we're seeing the tax rates on wealthy entities going down. The wealthier you are, the lower your rate, it seems to be. And that's not just an American phenomenon. Why was that the focus of this year's report?
Well, for the two reasons you mentioned. One, if you want to address poverty in this global economy, you're going to have to deal with global tax rates and structural inequality. Today, 262 million kids are not going to be able to go to school somewhere in the world because their public institutions don't have the funding to put them into school. 10,000 people are going to die from lack of basic health care, again, because their health systems are underfunded. Today, 16 million hours of unpaid care work will be done by women because, again, public services are not providing them with investments in water or electricity or childcare that would allow them to use their time more productively. So we have a huge problem on the global poverty side and with poverty in the United States. We think as Oxfam that one of the key answers to addressing this problem is to go where the real money is, which is sitting mostly idly in the pockets of the extreme wealthy and corporations.
So we have money in the world and it's not doing anything as it sits in these bank accounts. There's all sorts of ways in which, of course, the wealthy avoid taxes, but they first of all hide their money in offshore tax areas, low tax areas, and then they also lobby hard, often invisibly, to ensure that governments reduce their taxes. But let's talk about the impacts in a little bit more detail. Education is a big one. What is the impact that education has on inequality? And when that education is underfunded, of course, it has a big ripple effect. I'm here in Los Angeles, where there's this ongoing public school teachers strike. So we're seeing this effect of underfunded schools pretty seriously.
That's right. Well, if I could just cover both of the things you mentioned, because they're exactly as you mentioned them, and just give you a few facts for your listeners. So there's about $7.6 trillion sitting idly somewhere that belongs to the super wealthy or to corporations that are putting them into tax shelters. And basically, that's doing no work at all. That's about a tenth of the global economy is just sitting in these sort of private caches. And the reason that's happening is because basically we're not taxing incomes, we're not taxing wealth, and we're letting corporations engage in a global race to the bottom on paying taxes. So those resources are not going into the treasuries to pay for the services you talk about. And you're entirely right. If you want to build an inclusive economy where everybody has the opportunity to lift themselves from poverty, you invest, we all know it, in healthcare, education, and enough social protection to protect the most vulnerable. The thing that's perhaps different about the facts that people know now is, and who knows it, like the International Monetary Fund, years ago, they weren't arguing for public services or for the redistribution of income. They were arguing for the opposite. But today, and they say it's because if you want economic growth, you're going to have better education systems that are putting knowledge workers into the economy. You're going to have healthcare systems that ensure that healthy, productive people can join their economies. They're tying it to economic growth. And so it's made our case, because we do care about education and healthcare and equal rights for girls and women in those contexts, it's made our case hopefully more resonant with those folks who originally just cared about, let's just grow economies and hope that trickle-down policies will actually benefit people. They're starting to realize that trickle-down economics doesn't work.
So there's also the issue of basic healthcare, and of course, women's well-being is often seen as a measure. So not just the education of girls and women, but the healthcare of girls and women. And in particular, things like maternal mortality rates and infant mortality rates are pretty strong measures. How do we see a lack of proper healthcare services deeply impacting women in poor countries? I mean, it's right. Sometimes just a little bit of money can go such a long way.
That's exactly right. And we work in about 90 countries around the world, most of the countries where the extreme poor are, as well as in some of those G20 countries like India and China, which are seeing widening gaps between the extreme poor and the extreme wealthy. And what we see in context after context is that investments in public services, particularly three, healthcare, education, and social protection for the most vulnerable, have a disproportionate impact for women and girls every time. And the knock-on effect of investing in education for a young girl, it has this three-generational effect where communities benefit directly and indirectly. It's the best investments that you can make if you care about building an inclusive economy in which everyone benefits, because better educated women and girls leads to better educated families and an environment of equal rights and active citizenship that cuts across genders. And then we get much more accountable institutions that in the end of the day understand that it's in their long-term interests to be focusing on gender justice. So for us, healthcare, education, basic social protection, and those kinds of services that improve the ability of women to work productively, water, electricity, and childcare, are disproportionately the best investments that any country can make if it wants to have a healthier economy.
Right. There is a tremendous amount of unpaid work done by women that essentially keeps societies running that isn't acknowledged, that it's, since it's unpaid, it goes unacknowledged. And that has a deep impact on keeping the wealth gap pretty wide, right?
Estimated in our report that if you actually had all of the unpaid care work be working for one corporation, that corporation's annual turnover would be $10 trillion, 10 times larger than the largest corporation that's ever been seen. What we're permitting is economies globally, but also at the national level, where women are working harder and harder, either to stay still or, frighteningly, to fall further and further behind. One of the biggest concerns that we uncovered when we did the research for this report was that while the richest people on the planet, billionaires' wealth, increased by 12%, the wealth of the poorest half of humanity dropped by 11%. And so that's the widening gap. It's not just the extreme poor who live on less than $2 a day. It's those folks who are living on less than $5.50 a day. In many of the countries where we work, they're almost joining the middle class, but they're one crisis away from becoming extreme poor. It's the widening gap that they're experiencing that was most troubling to us.
And we're seeing that in the United States again. I mean, here we are 31 plus days into a federal government shutdown, and federal government employees, you would think, would be comfortably middle class, but after missing one, two paychecks, are about to join the ranks of far lower income people because they don't have the ability to save up enough of a nest egg to weather such a crisis as we have right now, right? I mean, so even those people who might see themselves in the middle class are so precariously in the middle class.
That's right.
And same with the teachers that are on strike that are losing pay.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, in Washington, you have many federal workers, many of them are friends, who are struggling now and are being forced to make increasingly drastic decisions. Our domestic poverty program works with both migrant workers and low-wage women workers all around the United States, with some focus in some countries. We documented in our Best States to Work Index, which you can get on our website, how few protections there are for many workers in the United States. And yes, you're entirely right. The fact that 1% of the population in the United States owns so much of the wealth, 35% of the wealth, is profoundly troubling. The notion of the American dream is being torn apart by the fact that we don't have a tax system that is designed to help people lift themselves from poverty and give them the ingredients to go after the American dream. So it is precisely a problem of extreme wealth here as well as around the world that we are facing today and must tackle.
So let's talk about what the report recommends. The report says the goal is free, quality public services for all. Sounds very simple, but of course it's a big ask. And some public services are free in some countries. It sort of depends on where you live, which I'm assuming those are countries where just those few free public services have such a big impact that they are great models to showcase how things could be if all public services were free in all countries, right?
Yes, that's right. And that is our ask. We know that some businesses can do a huge amount to improve the well-being of not just their customers, of their employees, and that the world for a long time has been driven effectively in many respects by private sector-led growth. But what we've come to realize is that the private sector is capable of doing some things, but not everything. And there is simply no replacement for a functioning, fair, affordable public education and public healthcare system. We see this in so many of the countries where we work. And there's a love fest right now in the philanthropy world and in other worlds with private sector solutions to all our problems. If we could just get corporations to do more well by doing good, we would solve our problems. We're not anti-innovation, but our experience working in these countries is that private sector solutions to the fundamentals of what makes a society work, healthcare, education, and basic protections for your most vulnerable, cannot be done by the private sector and won't be done effectively at the scale we need. So yes, that's our first ask: free, public, universal, fair healthcare, education, and social protection. But on the other side of the equation, we've got to see different tax regimes, not just more and more progressive income and wealth taxes. So much could be done with effective wealth taxation on a global level or even in countries like the United States. But we also have to tackle corporate tax avoidance. The reason so many billionaires are getting wealthier at an exponential rate is they hold a lot of their money in corporate shares. And when you deregulate corporations, they're going to put their money into profits, which end up in shares. Until we get serious about tackling tax competition, that's where corporations go around the world seeking the lowest tax rates, whether or not they do economic activity there. Tax avoidance, tax evasion, and a complete lack of transparency, we're not going to get the resources we need for those free, public, fair education and health systems anywhere.
So there are patchwork tax laws all over the world, which is why corporations basically shop around for where they can have the lowest tax rates. This is a global problem, but there are also in the wealthiest countries in the world, like the US, things that can be done to tackle these low tax rates. Aren't these, isn't it really popular to tax corporations more? It's not like there's some sort of lack of political will among the public. It seems as though a big part of the problem is that corporations have quite effectively used a little bit of their money to hijack our political systems, to convince us through propaganda, through funding political campaigns, and ensuring that tax rates remain low. So it's a political problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think both things you said are true. I think it's only more recently that it's become as obvious as you suggest that taxing corporations is going to be a politically resonant argument to make. President Trump gave a huge break to a lot of corporations under the name of responding to popular will, and called it a sort of an injection of growth into the economy. But people realized quite quickly, I think, it was like that person who brings the keg to the party at 3 a.m. and says, you know, your world's going to be better when you finish consuming this, and you wake up the next day and you realize that the high was very short-term and deeply regretted. We are now having a serious conversation across social justice organizations and amongst politicians around what we need to do to do serious tax reform that's going to be very different from what President Trump offered the American people. That having been said, you're entirely right that when we start that conversation, the primary force we're going to have to reckon with are the corporations who are able now, partly because of all this wealth, to hire armies of lobbyists who are going to do their level best to argue that taxing corporations fairly undermines American competitiveness and will make them lose out to their Chinese competitors and so on. And we have got to tackle that problem of political capture in our system forthrightly and make arguments that overwhelm the ranks of lobbyists.
So, Paul, right now there is a gathering of global elites, both corporate and state representatives, meeting in Davos, Switzerland. It's the annual World Economic Forum. And it's a bizarre gathering because it's not actually a formal body that's meeting. It's just this sort of business leaders deciding we should talk to politicians in order to solve world problems. It, just that sort of devil's deal, if you will, that you and I were just discussing. Also, as you said earlier, it seems as though the conversation has changed over the years as some of these wealthy elites have been forced to admit that trickle-down economics doesn't work. What is the main discussion at Davos this year? And this is a gathering that claims to be committed to doing good in the world.
That's right. Well, you're right. You know, when we first went to Davos and said, you know, we question whether a gathering of global elites is actually going to make our world any better unless you deal with the root cause of how you got here, which is extreme and structured inequality. We thought we'd never be asked to come again, and they would dismiss us as that sort of unwelcome guest who was rude enough to put some awkward truths into the party. In fact, over the years, they've asked us to do more research to document why structural inequality is bad for everyone, including them. And then they started to embrace the question of what they need to do differently or better in order to address it. Is everybody who goes to Davos equally committed? Absolutely not. Let's not fool ourselves. But there is a conversation now about what we are going to need to do to address global public challenges that are not simply affecting the poorest of the poor now, but are undermining whole economies. What will this Davos yield? We'll see. It started on Monday in earnest today. And what we are interested to see is that there are now actually voices that are asking the question, partly because of how you put it, should Davos continue to exist? Because I think what's behind a lot of this is if the real challenge to global and structural inequality is the concerted efforts of global elites to make sure that they are not regulated in ways that undermine their power, which is often expressed in the form of control of money. If that is the main impediment to addressing structural inequality, then why would you want them gathering together for concerted action? In itself, it becomes part of the problem. And the fatigue that many of us are experiencing is You can't simply argue for win-win solutions where there is no sacrifice on your end as part of the extreme wealthy. If we are going to have a world in which wealth and power are more equally distributed, you must do your part. And by doing your part, we mean having less wealth and less power to determine the well-being of so many others.
Now, Paul, the head of your organization, of Oxfam, Winnie Byanyima, she's the executive director of Oxfam, and she is one of the attendees at Davos. As you said, Oxfam has been at this forum, and apparently she's going to be calling for a new social revolution, as per the World Economic Forum's website. What does that mean? What sort of a new social revolution will she be calling for at this gathering of elites who might very well be the targets of her social revolution?
Winnie is our fearless leader and has been helping Oxfam to become an ever stronger voice in a what I would call a peaceful revolution of activism around a set of ideas to, and I'm quoting her, to redistribute power from the haves to the have-nots. What Winnie believes and has led us all to understand is that money in the end of the day is power. And what people want, as much as they want basic services, is more power in their own lives. And Winnie is asking those in Davos who have so much wealth and so much power, are they willing to be part of a creative revolution to redistribute power from the have to the have-nots in a peaceful way, where that economic compact and political compact come together? It is now almost a revolutionary idea that accountable politicians, accountable business leaders would be held to account by active citizens. And at the same time, that economic compact, they pay their taxes fairly in proportion to how much wealth they have. And those resources are used to provide the healthcare, education, and social protection that allows people to lift themselves from poverty. The revolution that Winnie is talking about is the coming together of an economic compact and a political compact that is how a world peacefully evolves into a better place. And she's asking for them to play their part.
Paul, give out the website where people can find the report that we've been discussing that Oxfam just released.
Yeah, the easiest place is to go to our main website, which is www.oxfam.org. Follow us on Twitter. It's going to be on Twitter over the next few days. If anyone wants to reach me, I'm at DPaul O'Brien on Twitter, and I'll make sure that whomever writes gets the report.
And the name of the report is Public Good or Private Wealth. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was great to be on.
Paul O'Brien is Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America. We've been discussing the annual Oxfam report on global inequality as the World Economic Forum in Davos opens and goes through this week. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.